The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Carabao Cup, another hat-trick for Dominic Calvert-Lewin as the Everton winning machine continues. Very strange to say that sentence out loud. Lots of fun at the Lane as Spurs beat Chelsea on penalties and Jose chases Eric Dier into the toilet. Newcastle limp past Newport and there are comfortable away wins for Manchester United and Manchester City. Elsewhere, should Foden and Greenwood miss out for England? We'll discuss the government's help for the National League. There's a Premier League preview. Bayern win the German Super Cup. We'll praise Landon Donovan, answer your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, he was listening to Carly Rae Jepsen, Call Me Maybe, as the Zoom call began, dancing away. Barry Glendening, I was not expecting that to be your hype music.
Well, nobody likes the grass, Max. I'm not ashamed of my secret love for the stylings of Carly Rae Jepsen.
Paul Doyle, nice to see you. How are you?
Yeah, fine. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thanks. Johnny Liu, hello.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
Pretty good. Sorry, it's been a bit of a chaotic morning.
Do you want to tell us more, or do you want us to just carry on?
I mean, it's baby related, so it's incredibly interesting to me and incredibly tedious to everyone else.
Do you think I should have a baby or not?
You can have ours if you want.
You're all right, to be honest. Let's start with this from Mags, who says, "What would you do to the League Cup to make it more interesting? Have a star X amount of homegrown players or under 23 players? Make it 7-a-side. At the moment, it's just kind of there as a silver carrot for smaller clubs to win before they inevitably don't." Paul, do you have a love for the League Cup? Do you think it needs any changes, or how do you feel about it?
I'm all for change. And the way it is at the moment, managers kind of have freedom to innovate. And one of the interesting things about it is some choose to field their strongest team. Some do go for almost an under-23 team. And so each club can choose their own approach accordingly. I personally would formalise that process and use it as a testing ground for all sorts of new rules, the sort of new rules that I've been advocating for a long time, you know, like goalkeepers not being allowed to catch the ball and fouls anywhere on the pitch leading to penalties if they're particularly cynical fouls, that's stopping a counter-attack, that sort of thing. That would be the perfect forum to trial these rules and prove me correct.
I think that's a very brave shout by Paul, considering the amount of grief he got last time he advocated this.
Well, that's because I was misquoted. People thought that I said the goalkeeper shouldn't be allowed to use their hands, which isn't what I said. I said they shouldn't be allowed to catch the ball, so they can push it back into play and bat it away, do everything, but just keep. I don't like when they catch the ball and just everything stops and everyone has to retreat and that's the end of the action. So just keep it going.
Have you like written up all your rule changes?
Not in one single anthology. But I have put them in various articles.
I think it's a very good idea. I saw Nicholas McGeehan was talking about that handball rule and the ridiculous penalties, saying, and I think a bit like you were saying, if you had the penalty area just for where the keeper could handle it, but penalties are decided in a different way. So if you're clean through on the halfway line, it's still a penalty. But if it's one of those handballs, it's just a free kick in the box.
Yeah, exactly. And all those ones where you just, you know, you pull down a guy when you see a counter attack starting, you get a yellow card, but that's the end of the attack. I mean, you've just aborted it. That should be an immediate penalty, and then you stop it. So the attack is allowed to play out naturally, which is what we all want.
Okay. Johnny, do you have any more thoughts on what should happen to the League Cup, or do you think Paul's done enough to change it in the last 3 minutes?
I mean, the League Cup, it's kind of even more pointless than it was, because this season, for the first time, instead of getting a Europa League place, the winners get a place in this pointless European Conference League, which is the one below the Europa League. So if it wasn't worth winning, you know last season, it's even less worth winning now. But the interesting thing is that it's actually become the most interesting competition by dint of the fact that very few people care about it. You know, you generally get goal fests and incredibly entertaining high scoring draws, and so I mean it has its place. I'd either scrap it or leave it exactly as it is.
Sorry, explain that European Conference League to me.
Oh right, so UEFA have just brought in their third tier competition from next season.
God.
So you have the Champions League, the Europa League, and then the winners of the Europa League qualify for the Champions League. And now below that, you have the European, I think it's called the European Conference League or the Europa Conference or you know, Europol or something. And the winners of that get into the Europa League for the following season. And it's meant for like the much smaller countries. It's meant for your Andorras and your San Marinos, but also the League Cup winners of those countries that are still unfortunate enough to still have a third cup competition.
Well, it's silverware, I guess, isn't it? I guess, Barry, it was quite nice to see some football without VAR, wasn't it?
Yeah, always a pleasure. I didn't actually realise that was the case until I was doing some prep for the Brighton-Manchester United minute-by-minute report, which I did last night, and yeah, I was relieved to see there was no VAR. I'm sort of in Johnny's camp in that I'd either scrap it or leave it exactly as it is, but watching it last night, it just seemed a real futile exercise, say, the Brighton-Man United game. I think there was two Brighton players who started against United on Saturday in the team, and Victor Lindelof was punished for something. He was the only Manchester United player that was selected for both games. And it was probably the best game Manchester United played all season. But you're kind of wondering, well, what's really the point? Because none of those players, or very few of them, are going to have done enough, despite playing really well, to play them into Ollie's plans for his next Premier League game. And there's no crowd there. The League Cup final is traditionally in February, is it March? Late February, early March. Chances are we'll go through the whole tournament without any crowds being at it. There's no crowd going to be at the final. There's too many fixtures at the moment this season because of the truncated season, and you just wonder what is the point of it all?
Well, I guess for Everton fans or Tottenham fans or Newcastle fans, it is a chance to win a trophy. And for Everton, hammered West Ham 4-1. They've won each of their opening six games of a campaign for the first time since 1938-39. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, first Everton player to score a hat-trick in the League Cup since Paul Rideout against Lincoln in 93. The first player to score hat-tricks in consecutive home games under Carlo Ancelotti since Cristiano Ronaldo in 2014. James Rodriguez played in all four matches, by the way. And he's had a great start to the season, Paul. I don't know how sustainable this is for Everton. I guess that's one question. Another question is Calvert-Lewin on form could potentially start for England in this international break?
Yes, indeed. He's doing everything right. I don't know how sustainable it is from his point of view either, but that's up to him to prove it. But he's doing everything he could be doing at the moment, isn't he? And he certainly deserves a call-up and probably a start.
Horatio says, can you spend 10 minutes discussing Dominic Calvert-Lewin's first goal from Keane's turn and pass to the first touch control and second side half volley? Johnny, I wondered if he slightly miskicked the finish. Am I being unfair?
Yeah, I think you often do get those sorts of goals when you're on a rich vein of form. I think his second goal as well was slightly scruffy, slightly lucky, came back off the post, I think. And when the, you know, things are going for you as a striker, then these things fall your way. But he's playing with incredible confidence at the moment. I mean, I saw him at Crystal Palace on Saturday, and one thing you notice about him now is he used to be like an incredibly busy forward. He'd pop up all over the forward line. You'd see him on the wings. You'd kind of see him in the channels. But I think under Ancelotti, Ancelotti's basically told him, you stay, you are our target man. Richarlison now does a lot of the kind of the wide work, and Calvert-Lewin, he maybe touches the ball 20 or 30 times in a game, but he is there in the centre as your focal point, and his job is to get into the area and get on the end of crosses. His heading is exceptional as well, and it could be a really big season for him. There is always a certain hype about players, you know, young strikers who hit the ground running in the first few games, and sometimes that hype runs away with us a little bit. I remember, you know, it happened to Callum Wilson a couple of seasons ago, and Clive Mendonca many years before that. But he's the real deal, Calvert-Lewin. And if he kind of continues this rate of progress, I don't see any reason why he can't become an England player and much more.
Could you play him and Kane together?
The way that Southgate seems to want to play Kane, no. But if you see Kane's kind of career trajectory going from, you know, a number nine to what he is now, is almost a kind of almost a false nine or sometimes a 10 in a lot of games, then potentially, you know, that could work, where you have Kane kind of dropping off and Calvert-Lewin on the shoulder of the last defender, which is something that Kane's less good at these days. That could work, but then how that works with your two wingers, with Sterling and Sancho, you know, where Rashford fits into this, I'm not sure either. But yeah, it's another dilemma and a nice one for Southgate to have.
Barry, how well do you think Everton can do? And are you surprised? I think someone tweeted to say, Everton Al said, how long would Barry have laughed for if 1 week before the season started, someone told him Everton would have won six games in a row at the start of the season?
Yeah, I would have laughed. I think consistency is the one thing Everton have consistently lacked over the years for as long as I've been watching. Well, not for as long as I've been watching them, because I still remember the Howard Kendall team with Peter Reid and Graham Sharp and all those guys, you know, who won things, an Everton side that consistently won things during the 80s. But since then, they have constantly lacked consistency. I used to get fed up, and I'm sure Seamus Coleman used to get fed up as well, of having to come out after yet another defeat against a decent side, or, you know, after once again failing to string more than two wins in a row together, coming out and explaining how we need a winning mentality and we need consistency. And so far this season, Carlo Ancelotti seems to have instilled that in them. The one thing I would say to you, Max, is you said earlier that for fans of teams like Everton and Newcastle, the Carabao Cup represents an opportunity to win a trophy. But I wonder, would Everton fans preferred not to have had that game last night and not to have lost Alan and Richarlison to injury? Alan's looks at least a 6-weeker. Richarlison, I've no idea. But I think he damaged his ankle. We'll find out today how long he's going to be out for. Would they prefer not to have had the game and not to have lost those two players to injury? I suspect maybe they would.
It's sort of a misnomer as well, that smaller teams, you know, get a better crack at the League Cup. It's, I mean, I think Manchester City won it the last 3 years in a row, and you haven't really had an outsider win it since Swansea in 2013, I think it was. So we've had an outsider win the Premier League more recently than we've had an outsider win this. It tends to get carved up by the same big teams as every other competition.
Are you saying it's harder to win than the Premier League, John?
Potentially, but no, I mean, it just seems like the you know, the same old teams just win this, and you know, the finals generally, was it City Chelsea last year, and
it was City Villa last year, and Villa got there because, of course, yeah, they faced second strings all the way up to the semi final, where they had a great win over Leicester. But before that, they beat like Liverpool's under-15s. And I think even Brighton put out a second team against them.
Spurs, Chelsea, then 1-1 draw. Spurs going through on penalties. I'm starting to believe in Jose, Johnny. Do I need someone to stage an intervention?
No, me too. I mean, it's something weird is happening there. I mean, all the old Jose tropes, like that. You know, this after the Newcastle game, he just apropos of nothing at all. He wouldn't talk about a handball. But it's like Tottenham are just not respected. Everybody disrespects us. And I mean, that was classic siege mentality. And, you know, people buy into this bullshit. You know, players buy into it. And even fans are now beginning to buy into it. And you know, he's very successfully, I think, forged this everyone is against us mentality, which is hard at Spurs, who have been kind of quite universally liked for most of the Pochettino era. That he's decided, you know, okay, now we're going to be the heel. And you know, however true that is in reality, you know, it's a bit like saying everyone outside this club is a werewolf. We're surrounded by werewolves, and everyone's like, oh gosh, right? Well, we better stick together then. and if you can do that, then people will ignore the fact that, you know, for the first 40 minutes of that game, you know, they should have been out of sight, and they basically failed to get out of their own half, but they beat one of their biggest rivals on penalties, and I guess that's got to feel pretty good.
Yeah, I guess It was a game of two halves. I thought Ndombele looks really fun, doesn't he? Someone tweeted me going, he looks like he sort of plays like he's the best player in the school, where he just waits for everyone to be around him and then he spins around a bit. He has a touch of the Dembeles.
He does. Yeah,
slightly awkward way. And his name is very similar.
The ball is the last thing to come with him in a weird way. And Dembele was a bit like that as well. He moves and then hang on. Where's the ball? Okay, and finally, and defenders take a little half a second to get used to it. I think he's a lovely player to watch. And then he tries things in the final third, which is something that Tottenham actually haven't been doing a lot of in the last few months, really. And he will give the ball away. He will have games where he looks terrible, and because of his style, it will look like he's just, you know, basically phoning it in. But it's not. It's just the way he plays. He has kind of an easy style to him. And there was that big hug between Mourinho and Ndombele at the end of the game, which everybody saw as this kind of redemptive moment, like Matt Pryor and Kevin Peterson on the tour of India in 2012-13 after they'd won in Mumbai, going reintegration complete. It was like a very touching moment that will probably be undone in a couple of months when Mourinho digs him out again in the media.
I thought Reguilon made a promising start. It was his mistake for the goal, but you know, he looks like he adds a bit of balance down the left for Spurs. For Chelsea, Mendy had one flat, but apart from that, he looks like a very sensible signing and looks just a better goalkeeper than Kepa. Have we talked enough about the game, Barry, to now discuss Eric Dier going for a poo and Jose chasing him down the tunnel going, Eric, and trying to work out if this is incredibly funny or what's everyone fussing about?
Well, I think in a nutshell, the story is man needs the loo, and it's not that interesting. I'm not sure what Jose thought he was doing, if he was going to like run down the tunnel out of the stadium and off down the Seven Sisters Road, and was slightly concerned about that, but that clearly wasn't the case. You did gloss over Reguilon's debut there. I thought he was hugely impressive, actually, for his first game. You know, one swallow doesn't make a summer, but it certainly made Monday evening. Yeah, man goes to toilet. Not that interesting. I would also be interested to know that if he did go on the pitch, is it Jose's responsibility to come out with one of those little plastic bags and, you know, wrap it around his hand and pick it up and tie a knot in it, deposit it in the nearest bin? I've no idea what the etiquette is there. Does he get fined if he just leaves it there?
Jose would throw it into the opposite dugout.
Newport 1, Newcastle 1. Newcastle going through on penalties after that late equaliser. Lovely finish from Shelvey. Huge fan of him putting his fingers to his lips to an empty stadium. Apparently the Newport coaching staff or the subs were giving verbals through the game. Ryan says, can we finally all acknowledge that Steve Bruce is so far out of his depth at Newcastle, or are his media pals still out to keep him employed forever? Barry, are you out to keep him employed forever?
No, not in the slightest. It's a tricky one. There seems to be no middle ground in this discussion over Steve Bruce. A large section of Newcastle fans think he's useless. Anytime the team wins, they put it down to bad luck or the incompetence of the opposition. Anytime they lose, they get on his back. He does have media pals who stick up for him relentlessly. There's no question about that. And I saw this game yesterday. They were very poor in the first half, diabolically bad. Picked up a bit in the second half. Interestingly enough, when Joelinton came on, he made a big difference. They were probably lucky to draw, having said that. But, you know, he finished. Where did they finish last season? It was 10th, 11th, something like that. You know, they were didn't come anywhere close to being relegated anyway. I can't remember the exact position. They got through last night, although, you know, it was a bit of a scramble over the line. And I having seen their game at the weekend, I can understand the frustration of Newcastle fans. I can also understand that Bruce is, to a certain extent, working with one hand tied behind his back, although he did make some, you know, decent-looking signings over the summer. And I think he's on an absolute hiding to nothing at Newcastle. The fans just don't like him. I can understand to an extent why, when you see the tactics he employs sometimes, and he does seem to be riding his luck a bit. But also, I think he doesn't get any credit at all when he deserves some.
You also did the MBM for Brighton Manchester United. What did you make of the game?
The first half was awful. The second half, there was some decent goals. Manchester United won it handily enough in the end. It was kind of watching all these players, particularly Manchester United players, who don't really have a future at the club. Many of them, you suspect, are certainly not. They're not going to be first-team staples. Toil valiantly in the pouring rain in Brighton on a horrible night. You know, just something sort of heroic about it, I suppose.
The second time in 4 days, isn't it?
Yeah, I did enjoy whoever was in charge of the fake crowd noise for Sky was... They weren't really on top of their brief, I think, and there was one moment near the end where the fake Brighton crowd got very excited about not much because they were 3-0 down. And you'd have thought, you know, they wouldn't have got, a real crowd wouldn't have got excited. And I suspect this fake crowd would have already left at that point to beat the fake traffic and get home because it was a really lousy night. But I would say the game wasn't entirely without merit. Eric Bailly was very impressive alongside Victor Lindelof for Manchester United. He's given Solskjaer something to think about. And I wouldn't be surprised if he starts their next game. Juan Mata was man of the match, and so it was nice to see, because Juan Mata's just a lovely man. There was one stage where him and Dan Byrne sort of squared up to each other, and it was quite funny because Dan Byrne is approximately twice his height. Dan James, I don't think he has a future at United. I think he's just not good enough. He kept giving the ball away. He didn't play particularly well.
I didn't see that game. But what was Van de Beek like? Because his signing is interesting, because I don't think that you can play Van de Beek, Pogba and Fernandes together in midfield, especially against the top teams. So I'm wondering, are we going to have a new Pogba saga? Because he looks like the one most likely to make way if Van de Beek is as good as people think.
Sorry, I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot to mention him. He was very impressive, and he had a lovely little back-heeled weighted pass to Mata for Mata's goal. I was impressed with him. I would imagine he's probably put himself... He hasn't started a Premier League game yet. He could well start the next one. Pogba came on for Dan James in the second half, scored with a very good free kick. Bit of luck to it. It took a big deflection, but... he was sort of in line with the left side of the penalty area and aimed for the near top corner, and it went in off the wall. I think I was quite critical of Pogba on Monday's pod, so he deserves a bit of credit for that. But yeah, I was impressed with Van de Beek.
Can you give credit to someone who takes a free kick if it only goes in because it's deflected off
the wall?
Well,
I mean, you could see what he was trying to do, and he did pull it off, albeit with the aid of a deflection. So, yeah.
Borussia Dortmund have told United there's no point in bidding less than €120 million for Jadon Sancho after discussions between the clubs on Tuesday. United are in discussions with Barcelona over Ousmane Dembele. Johnny, what do you make of their lack of transfer business? Some Man United fans are getting very hot under the collar.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely seems like a need for renewal there. I mean, Van de Beek, from what I saw of him last night and on what I've seen of him this season, he's going to be a really good signing for them. But what they need, I think, is some sort of reinforcement in defence. They possibly need a new left back. The Sancho thing is interesting because he clearly fits the profile of a Manchester United PLC signing. He's a very exciting young English player, a guy with incredible social media presence, you know, a very famous footballing man. Is he what that team needs most right now? Probably not. You'd probably say another centre half or a left back. I mean, I'm not hearing a huge amount of movement or buzz in that direction, and I think that's kind of what they need to be doing it, rather than, you know, this kind of Sancho red herring who you know, like Paul says, they're already very well stocked in forward areas. why are they pursuing this incredibly, this moonshot transfer, you might almost say, almost neglecting the areas of the pitch that, that need addressing most urgently?
It's just more fun to sign attacking players.
It is, isn't it?
I think that that's true for managers as well as, you know, people who play Football Manager. City won 3-0 at Burnley, 2 for Raheem Sterling. Ferran Torres got his first for the club. Sterling has 33 goals for City since the start of last season, the most of any Premier League player in all competitions in this period. City have bought Ruben Diaz. Well done to Cole Palmer, who made his debut for City. Born on the 6th of May 2002, when number one in the charts was Holly Valance and Kiss Kiss. Liverpool, Arsenal, Brentford, Fulham, Villa, Stoke and the Carabao turn up. Also tonight, the Europa League, which just doesn't work for the pod, being on a Thursday. We'll have forgotten about it by Monday. But Spurs play Maccabi Haifa. Rangers play Galatasaray, FK Sarajevo, Celtic and Dundalk play KL Klasnik. Interesting story from the Faroe Islands, that side. They could be the first time a team from the Faroes qualifies for a group stage of any European competition. So we'll keep an eye on that one. That'll do for part one. We'll begin part two talking about the England squad. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the England squad's going to be announced this afternoon. Paul, do you think Foden and Greenwood, by all accounts, they're going to miss out? Do you think that's the right decision?
I wouldn't have been pushed if he did recall them, because they're young lads who made a mistake. It was a pretty serious mistake in the context. So I think that if you can afford to give them a bit of extra time out of the side, then you should. And it's a position where England are well stocked. So leaving them out will help them focus their minds so that they don't do that sort of thing again. Hopefully it means that Jack Grealish will be getting another call-up, for example. And even I very much hope that Harvey Barnes is included. I think there's one player who could make a real push to get into the European Championship squad for England next summer in a position where England have lots of strong options. It's Harvey Barnes, who I think is set up to have a great season.
He's an interesting player, isn't he, Harvey Barnes, in that I wasn't sure if he sort of had the end product.
That's the one aspect of his game that he needs to improve is his finishing. And he is showing signs of improving there and making better decisions when he gets into these areas. But he's brilliant at getting into the areas. He's fast, he's direct, he's skillful, he's clever. And he just gets a little bit rash at the last sometimes. But he's only 21, I think, and he's honing that talent.
Johnny, do you think it's easy for Southgate to drop these two players right now? Had it been just before the Euros, do you think he'd make a different decision?
Yeah, and I think he's generally tried to be quite consistent with these things. He seems to like putting players, you know, not like it, but he definitely doesn't show much compunction in putting players on the naughty step for a game or two if he thinks that, you know, he needs to lay down the law. And I think he's got kind of standards of discipline that he wants to enforce. I remember he banned Sterling for a game after he had his ruckus with Joe Gomez on at one camp. And of course, you know, there was the Harry Maguire stuff as well. So, yeah, I think it's in keeping with what he's done in the past, and I guess ironically, if you're a City fan or a United fan, you'd be absolutely delighted that Foden and Greenwood are missing this very tightly packed triple header.
Friendly against Wales on October the 8th, Nation League games against Belgium and Denmark on the 11th and 14th. Handball, Barry. After the criticism from managers and players, the Premier League club executives on Tuesday endorsed a change which will give referees more leeway in interpreting the law. The change has been endorsed by IFAB, evil IFAB. The strategy will be implemented from this weekend, and it's expected to flip the approach applied in preceding weeks. Instead of looking for unnatural body shapes, a referee will be invited to consider whether a player could be expected to have their arms in such a position, given the way they were standing or how they were interacting with opponents. Do you think this is a good thing?
Not particularly. I just think it's going to lead to a raft of different problems and controversies. This handball problem, you know, while it is annoying, I wouldn't say it's end of days stuff like some have maintained. Hello, Jamie Carragher and others. this is what people who wanted VAR, this is the game they wanted. Now they have it, they're still not happy. If you wanted VAR, if you were calling for VAR, this is on you. And I think the manner in which IFAB have apparently crumbled in the face of Premier League resistance so quickly is slightly pathetic. And while I would like not to see repetition of the stuff we had over the weekend, I just think we're going to see, as I say, just different controversies regarding the same thing, or different kinds of controversies.
Do you know where all this started? The conversation, I mean, this cycle of clamour, of this rolling, snowballing call for video technology to come in. It started with Thierry Henry's handball against Ireland in 2009. That was almost like, you know, 0 hour for, okay, we've got to do something about this now.
And sorry, could I quickly interrupt there? I wouldn't necessarily agree. I would say I've always traced year zero back to the Frank Lampard goal that was disallowed when it crossed the line but was ruled out.
Yeah, the following summer, but I guess specifically with handball, and then, you know, there was this kind of rolling conversation. If you can't, you know, delegitimate a goal like that is so clearly, you know, illegal, then you know, we've got to do something about that. And the ironic thing is, under this latest change, a referee could conceivably conclude that Thierry Henry's handball against Ireland was actually not handball, because his hand is an entirely expected position. I mean, a referee would probably make a call on intent there, but there's actually very little latitude in the rules for him to judge intent. It's the only consideration is his hand in an expected position, and it kind of is. It's pretty much by his side. So Henry's handball, if it was given as a goal on the pitch, might well not have been chalked off under VAR as it currently stands in the Premier League.
Yeah, that goal was given.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it caused a lot of trouble.
I mean, it would have been great if it went to VAR and they said, nah, that's not handball. Anyway, more football admin news. Decision by the FA to ban supporters of elite clubs at FA Cup second round qualifying matches this weekend has been met with some ridicule from some people after it emerged that several behind closed doors fixtures will be streamed live on TVs into indoor social clubs just yards from the pitch. It seems a strange. They've obviously made this rule about non-elite clubs can have fans and elite clubs can't, so you have to draw the line somewhere. But that does mean that fans of non-elite clubs will be able to go to FA Cup games and elite club fans won't, as if you support a non-elite club, you're less likely to transmit COVID than if you support an elite club, which seems slightly weird. The government have told National League clubs that they will receive an emergency grant to help them start the new season, so that is good news. The DCMS is, quote, working at pace to design a package of support that will give the National League the reassurance it needs. Grants to cover essential revenue lost from fans not returning. The government recognises the immediate pressure National League clubs are under in respect of starting their season, are committed to play, resuming in a viable way. So that's due to begin on the 3rd of October, this Saturday. Regional 6th tier, North on the 5th and South on the 6th of October. On Tuesday, the Premier League held what were described as, quote, measured talks over possible £250 million bailout of the EFL. No agreement's been reached. Clubs are known to have concerns over their own finances. We'll hold a further meeting next Tuesday.
Matt Lawton actually had a bit in the Times this morning being Thursday. I said on Monday that, you know, it would be a mistake to think that the Premier League are just going to throw wads of cash at these clubs to help them out. It will be low interest loans and there will be strict conditions applied. And according to Matt, the Premier League are already asking the EFL to row in with them in their attempts to... It's a Brexit-related matter over elite clubs being allowed to sign foreign teenagers from outside Europe. I'm not going to pretend I understand the nitty-gritty of it, but the upshot is that it would be to the detriment of football league teams in the long term, because it would significantly reduce their chances of selling young players for a lot of money.
Any agreement will come with caveats.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that was always going to be the case. And Matt Lawton seems to have flagged one up immediately straight off the bat. I think another one is that unless there's a very real chance this season won't finish if there's another lockdown. And apparently the Premier League are stipulating that if it doesn't, unless it's played, I think 75% of fixtures are fulfilled, they're saying it should be abandoned. Therefore, there would be no relegation, no right. promotion.
Okay. We do want to do, I think in the international break, going to try and do a special on the EFL because there's a lot to cover on this. Some potentially good news for Wigan. David Conn tweeting out a press release from Wigan last night. Says, we're pleased to announce that we've reached agreement with a preferred bidder from Spain. The offer that's been accepted deals not only with the sale of the club, also allows the payment to non-football creditors to avoid the 15-point penalty this season. In addition, a substantial deposit's been received. We are now working with our lawyers and the bidder to produce all of the necessary paperwork to submit to the EFL so that successful transfer of the football share can be made at the earliest opportunity. Meanwhile, the final nail in the coffin for Macclesfield, which we all expected and which John Bruin spoke about so brilliantly the other week. They've been expelled from the National League 13 days after being wound up by the High Court. They had been suspended from the league prior to that date, with all scheduled fixtures before that date being postponed. Players and staff had been made redundant in the wake of the ruling. So it is the end of Macclesfield Town as we know it, which is incredibly sad. That'll do for part two. Part three, we will look ahead to the weekend's Premier League fixtures. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Bayern beat Dortmund 3-2 in the German Super Cup last night. Josh Kimmich spooning the winner in near the end as he was falling to the ground. Johnny, you wrote a piece about Dortmund recently. What was your essay about?
Well, I guess people talk about the Dortmund model as this incredible shining example of how I guess a small or a medium-sized club thrives in a world of super clubs and financial giants and you know, state-backed clubs. We all know the Dortmund model. It's you know, you buy teenagers, you buy extremely young players, Jadon Sancho, Erling Haaland, Gio Reyna, Jude Bellingham, the latest, and you essentially sell them on at a huge profit. After Ousmane Dembele, I guess the main one who sold to Barcelona for about 110, 120 million. And you know, the piece was kind of, this is an incredibly successful financial model for them. It's allowed them to kind of maintain their financial position, and it's generated hundreds of millions in transfer fees, in transfer revenue for them. In the same time, they've won one trophy in 8 years. So does this model actually work? And I guess, does it, you know, what constitutes success for a club that has no realistic ambitions to dominate their domestic league or dominated Europe? Is this kind of the best Dortmund can do? Or are they essentially a sort of feeder club where everyone's kind of passing through and you get good players for 2 or 3 years and sell them on and that's just their lot? So that's kind of what it was about, and you know, characteristically, I sort of sat on the fence. But I would say it's a big season or two for them. They've definitely signalled their intention to keep hold of Sancho, or at least demand very, very top dollar for him. And you know, the word is that they generally feel like there's a title they can challenge Bayern for the title this season. They came, I think, within a couple of points 2 seasons ago. That's the longer term question. Is it kind of depressing that a team like Dortmund, that everybody admires for their football and their business model, are sort of willingly confining themselves to this sort of feeder role, talent factory status?
It's interesting, I guess, how you define success and whether success in itself matters, in the sense that most football fans and most people listening to this will support teams who don't win anything this year and probably won't win anything next year, and haven't won anything for years, yet we keep coming back, right? We keep following it. So I don't know if you need success or what you need to have, Paul.
Yeah, I agree with you. One other thing you have to consider about Dortmund is they it's a brilliant place to watch football, and they get whatever 80,000 fans every week. It's a great atmosphere, and it's a great day out. And for similar reasons that a lot of fans prefer their team to be in the Championship in England, where they'll, you know, not win every match, but they'll win now and again, rather than battling against relegation and just having a season of drudgery at the bottom of the Premier League. So success is related to the experience you have in watching your team, and it doesn't necessarily hinge on lifting a trophy.
And also, I feel nostalgia is such a massive part of the game, right? That you know, I think half of our listeners are not in the UK. We talk about the Premier League a lot, but they will watch Premier League games with the same people in the same bar or whatever, and they will talk about something that happened. But, you know, Barry won't talk about that Brighton United game in 2 weeks, but 2 weeks' time. But, you know, when you talk about Eric Dier running to the tournament or whatever in 5 years' time, and actually that is almost as important as whether Tottenham win the League Cup this season.
Yeah, I mean, people will remember the Eric Dier poo game much longer than they remember, the score. Tottenham 1, Chelsea 1, Tottenham win 5-4 on penalties. I mean, that's kind of always been one of the quirks of the game. But yeah, I think Dortmund provide an incredible spectator experience, and you know, there's certainly very little sense of discontent from their fans at how the club is run, and they've certainly established themselves as Germany's kind of bona fide number two club, which I guess hasn't always been their status, and certainly wasn't guaranteed, and their whole business model came out of basically almost going into financial ruin about 10-15 years ago. But emotionally, it's interesting. It's an interesting conundrum. There was somebody in the comments, a Norwich fan, who said the emotional connection with your team is slightly different when you know that they're basically passing through. You get two or three seasons and they go, and you're supposed to, you know, applaud the system, and people go on about what a well-run club you are. You don't really attach yourself to these guys because they are essentially assets.
Let's look ahead to the games in the Premier League. Barry, Leeds Man City is Saturday night 5:30 is exciting for lots of reasons, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. I love watching Leeds. I was chatting to my dad on Monday, who I think used to love football and isn't that keen on it anymore. He's kind of given up on it, but he's really warmed to this Leeds side, which I think is indicative of how excited people are about them, how excited people are about Marcelo Bielsa. And I was giving him he didn't really know anything about Bielsa, and I was giving him chapter and verse because I've been aware of his work for over 10 years now because of Wilson. And I was excited that he was so excited about watching Leeds, and they may well get tonked, but I have no doubt it will be an entertaining game.
Does your dad still listen to the pod, Barry, or has he ever?
No, not. I think he listens from. I think my mum listens, and he will occasionally tune in if it happens to be on in the same room.
Is he proud of you?
No.
Paul, what do you think about Leeds City? It would be interesting to see how City react after getting pumped by Leicester, right?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how Leeds approach it. But I think we know how they'll approach it. They'll go all out attack. They won't take the style that worked so well for Brendan Rodgers last week. They'll go all out attack. So it'll be exciting. That's what we were talking about a moment ago. You want to see your team attack.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. I said they may well get pumped. I don't necessarily think they will, but it could happen.
That's kind of what is, I think, so fascinating about this game, that the whole gamut of results is sort of possible, from Leeds 0, Manchester City 7, to Leeds 4, Manchester City 1, I think, and or anything in between, including a 5-all draw or a 0-0 draw. These two teams will take risks on the ball and will adapt to the game as well. So, I think that it's one of those rare fixtures that genuinely you don't know what's going to happen, and you have no real clue how it's going to pan out.
What is interesting about the two men is they both have very pure visions of football, very definite visions of how the art of football should be performed. And in Guardiola's case, he thinks, well, because I have such a highbrow vision of art, I need to have the very best players because I'm striving for perfection, so I have to have technically brilliant players. But Bielsa, who has similarly, if not even higher, brow vision, pursues the same thing, but not with the best players. He clearly, you know, man for man, City have better players, but somehow, maybe it's because he has a different personality, he manages to coax even something even more from lesser players. Will it be enough to beat City, Guardiola's City?
Johnny, what's the gamut of possible scores for Manchester United Tottenham?
Goal in either way, I think. You know, so
anything from 1-0 at one extent to 1-0.
No, I think they're both fragile enough defensively that there is a fair gamut there. You know, you can certainly see United's getting breached a couple of times. You can certainly see Tottenham always have a concession in them, and then of course you have the fact that it's been a very high scoring season, and you bring in the fact that we have this kind of penalty epidemic in the Premier League so far this season.
Now, Everton Brighton is an interesting one on Saturday. Villa play Liverpool on Sunday. 200% records there. Paul, what do you make of the Ross Barkley signing?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think everything Villa have done is interesting this summer. I mean, Dean Smith did say that if they survive, even before they survived relegation last year, he said, if we survive relegation, just watch us go, because our two billionaire owners are going to really invest big, because they've got big dreams. Barkley is an interesting question. I still don't know how good he is. Obviously, I've seen him have some brilliant matches, but I've also seen him have stinkers. He should play a lot this season, because Dean Smith says he wants to play a settled team, and ideally, you know, the idea of a manager knowing their first 11 became a little bit antiquated a few years ago, because we always heard it was a squad game and you change it from match to match. But now we're moving back towards managers trying to have a consistent team every week, in some cases anyway. And Dean Smith wants that. So Ross Barkley should play a lot if he deserves to. So he's got a great chance to show us just how good he is. And if he is as good as he suggests he can be when he performs well, if you can do that regularly, then Villa have a really good chance of making it into the top half this season, because I think they've taken some risky signings. Bertrand Traoré, there's question marks about him. Again, a lot of potential. Matty Cash, same. If they can fulfil their potential, they're going to be really good. And Ollie Watkins looks a great signing, even though he hasn't scored yet.
We got accused of anti-Aston Villa bias following Tuesday's pod, I think it was, because Jordan said he didn't think Dean Smith would be able to keep them up. So having an opinion is clearly anti-Aston Villa bias. But Barkley is a good signing, I think. Like Paul, I've no idea how good he is or how good he can be, but looks like, I suppose, Conor Hourihan will make way for him, which is slightly disappointing from an Ireland point of view. But the thing about Barkley was really hitting his stride just as lockdown began, and it was bad timing for all of us, obviously, but particularly bad timing for a player who's always been plagued by accusations that he's a bit flaky and inconsistent, and he was showing remarkable consistency just as football shut down. So I think it's a good move for him.
Yeah, I think Dean Smith is a really good manager, and I think he'll do very well there. I think they've got as good a chance this season with that team under Dean Smith as they have under any other manager. Will be really interesting, because one thing we do know Ross Barkley is really good at is running with the ball and beating players, which is, of course, Jack Grealish tends to do a lot. So when you have more players who can do that in the team, Jack Grealish might get fouled slightly less often, because looking at the foul statistics for last season, is he was the most fouled player in the Premier League by a million miles. It's incredible. Wilfred Zaha, I think he was fouled 47 times more than Wilf Zaha, who gets attacked at every game. It's incredible.
It's worth it every time, because there's so few other people that could hurt you.
Yeah, and Villa have developed real set piece prowess. So when they are fouled, you think you're stifling the danger, but you're actually not. Although their best deliverer of set pieces is actually Conor Hourihan, and if he makes way for Barkley, somebody else will have to do that.
Well, look, thanks for rectifying the anti-Villa bias, and thank you, Barry, for pointing out who the pandemic had hit the hardest across the world. It was Ross Barkley. Chelsea, Palace, Newcastle, Burnley, Leicester play West Ham. Interesting to see. That's a two sides with big wins in the last round of Premier League games. Southampton, West Brom and Arsenal v Sheffield United. As we record this, it is 24 years to the day since Arsene Wenger succeeded Bruce Rioch as Arsenal manager. Boyd Hilton, the TV reviewer, tweeting, Arsene Wenger will be a guest on the Graham Norton show on October the 16th, along with Dawn French, Freddie Flintoff, Michael Kiwanuka and Samuel L. Jackson, who I fully expect to ask Mr. Wenger if he regrets not leaving Arsenal on a high after the FA Cup win in 2015. Wolves play Fulham as well, who brought in Ademola Lookman to shore up their defence. So that'll help. Have you seen this Landon Donovan in the States overnight, taking his second division team, the San Diego Loyal, off the pitch after an alleged homophobic slur uttered at one of his players? The target, Colin Martin, the only openly gay male pro athlete competing in US team sports. And I saw Donovan sort of interviewed after the game, saying that they, in the previous week, one of their players had been racially abused. And in that moment, they'd played on and they regretted doing it. And they'd made a real concerted effort this week. They talked about, you know, action, not words. And it showed some real leadership from Landon Donovan, I thought. It's important to point out, in a statement, Phoenix said their player denies using a homophobic slur. Phoenix Rising is investigating the claim of a homophobic slur, the club statement said, being used by one of its players who has vehemently denied these allegations. Phoenix Rising stands with the USL in rejecting and punishing any homophobic behaviour. The USL also confirmed investigation into the incident had been open. We are aware of the alleged use of a homophobic slur, the league said in a statement. Foul and abusive language of any type has absolutely no place in our society and will not be tolerated in USL matches. An investigation is currently underway to determine the facts surrounding the incident, and more information will be provided as soon as it is available. I don't know if any of you have seen him talking or seen the incident.
Yeah, I saw him talking. Donovan spoke brilliantly, and his team seemed to have done themselves out of a playoff place because they've lost a point last week for forfeiting the point they won, and they presumably lose three in this game as well for not finishing the game. So hats off to him. He spoke brilliantly.
You know, you can find people and you can condemn people online, and you can retroactively sort these things out. But sometimes the most powerful response has to be in the moment on the pitch, and I think this was another of those moments that proved that.
Mm. And I don't know. I've sensed that clearly we've spoken a lot about racism on this podcast, and a lot's been said about it. And you think people are taking it seriously. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Clearly it does. But I don't know if homophobia is taken as seriously, in my experience of park football and just sort of generally, I don't know if it is. So I think this is a really important step by Landon Donovan. And maybe other people have done it before, but I don't recollect that happening. So I think it's he deserves our praise, I think. Did anyone see, in far less important news, the lineup for Manchester United under-21s away at Rochdale included consecutively a player called Fish and a player called Pie? I very much enjoyed those two being together. Daz said, didn't Newcastle once field a team with Shearer, Court, Bellamy giving Gina speed? Which is great to have a full sentence in a lineup. And we'll finish with Pravesh saying, following up on Barry's house doorbell, has anyone actually rung the doorbell apart from Barry till now?
The postman rang it about 20 minutes after I installed it.
And then he rang it again.
Oh, very good. Yes, sorry. Took a while for the penny to drop there.
Finally, Wi-Fi Kayaker says, which of the regular panellists would Barry choose to be a Supreme Court judge?
I think Jonathan Wilson would be incredibly fair and has the necessary gravitas and pomposity to be a Supreme Court judge.
Is Barney ruled out by the fact that he has the legal training?
Barney wouldn't enjoy being a Supreme Court judge. I think Wilson would love it.
If you look at a lot of legal opinions, it's all based on precedent, isn't it? They talk about precedent. They go back years and years, and you know, Wilson is nothing if not a man of extreme precedent.
Anyway, glad we got that sorted out. And that'll do for today. Thank you for your time, Barry.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.